Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy, and share.
So welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Anton Rowe is Chief Executive at payroll and finance software company MHR International, where he started as an apprentice back in the 1990s. When he took over as Chief Exec in 2017, the company's turnover was £50 million and it employed 600 people. Today, that turnover has increased to more than £134 million. And last year, MHR took on its 900th member of staff at its campus HQ on the edge of Nottingham. MHR manages human resources for scores of big-name companies, universities and government departments, including Admiral, Trailfinders, Companies House and the National Gallery. It's an award-winning family firm and a great success story that has just celebrated 40 years in business. It also has a prestigious Royal Warrant for the supply of payroll and HR systems, and it's one of the Sunday Times 100 best places to work in Britain. So Anton Rowe, CEO of MHR, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So you now handle the salaries of more than 2 million people, which is, I think, more than 7% of the British workforce. Quite a responsibility.
It is. And it's a growing number. And obviously, it's a big responsibility that we take very seriously, but we're also very proud of the fact we do process that number of people. And I think it's something in the region of 30% of the UK public sector in that number. So,
does it keep you awake at night?
it can do. It certainly can do. And I know it's a long time ago, but certainly, you know, during COVID, we were classed as a key worker because, you know, whilst, you know, people were in lockdown, we had to keep the country moving and keep people paid.
Right, got you. So,
you've been CEO for 7 years, and in that time, MHR has more than doubled turnover, increased workforce by more than a third. So, in leadership terms, what do you think you've done that's made a difference?
Well, I think I think the big thing is it's making sure that everybody understands that the mission that we're on. I think communications is a big part. We want everybody aligned, you know, because it's easy just to say we need to sell more. It's not straightforward as that. And I think certainly we've experienced our fair share of growing pains as a company's growing. But the most important thing I think I hope I've bought at least, is making sure that there is a common message and people understand the vision and the journey that we're on. And that resonates with every type of worker, because how we might convey that to a team of salespeople is not the way we convey it to a team of software engineers or a team of consultants. So I think we've tried to just make sure that vision and what we're trying to achieve and why it's so important is absolutely crystal clear, and people are on that journey with us. Because then you actually get buy-in to what you're trying to achieve, and you get a degree of unity, everybody pulling in the same direction.
And has that been a difficult process, or was it something that came quite naturally to you?
I think when I took over as CEO, you know, and I've come from I'm a nerd, I'm a technologist at heart, and I used to like tinkering around with my home computer, and I was from that generation who had BBC Micros or ZX Spectrums or Commodore 64, so. I see myself as a nerd. So I went from being a chief technology officer where, you know, I was, you know, I've always been paid to do my hobby of working with computers and building stuff. So when the opportunity came, I think I had a moment's sort of hesitation, thinking, well, actually, I've now got to be able to work across not just a team of engineers and architects and designers. I've actually now going to go and work with the people I've been battling with in sales and consultancy, you know, the sales team trying to sell software we haven't got, or consultants complaining about software we've produced. I think, well, actually, I've now got to try and harmonize these people. But I think because I've proved myself in the company, and I've always had courage in my convictions, and the way I've always approached a new opportunity is, am I as good as the last guy that did it? And I convinced myself that I am, you know. So therefore, I think, well, I'll get rid of that sort of imposter syndrome that can occur. So really what I've got to do is I don't need to prove myself to people because people know who I am, but I've probably got to show that I understand the world that they live in. So empathize with the sales guys, empathize with the consultants, empathize with other parts of the business where previously, maybe whilst that was important, it probably wasn't as important as moving into this role.
Okay, so as you've laid out there, you've laid out a number of things that we'll come back to because they're really interesting. But you were a technical expert first. I mean, I believe your first big senior management position was a software director. But since you've become a strategic leader, so what skills did you have to acquire on the way, and how did you pick those ones up?
Well, I think I've always been pretty good at analyzing a problem and finding the best solution with it. And I've never been afraid to go and talk to people and get other people's opinions, which I think is important. And it's very easy in the world of software engineering for technology to try and find a home rather than coming up what the business need is. And even going back to my early days when I used to work in IT, it was all about understanding what people's problems were and how best to fix it. And if you were to take that a step further, within business, you are faced with what is it we're trying to achieve, and how do we best achieve that? So the conversation changes a little bit, but fundamentally, you're trying to identify the need, and then you're trying to identify the best way in which we're going to deliver that need. And whether or not you're designing a product or you're trying to scale out a business, there are certain building blocks that you need to understand. Why are we doing this? Why is it important? What are our options for delivering that, and what do we think is going to give us the best outcome?
What's interesting, perhaps unusual, is that it was the development of your technical skills and your recognition that you needed to understand people a bit better in terms of the customer facing nature of business that helped with your development of your overall leadership. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was if I go back to my very first role at MHR, working in the IT team. So, and a big part of what we did was go and support the business with their IT problems. So invariably you having to ask people what the problems were. And then it wasn't long before that actually I was doing customer facing work, and the big part, they ring you up with the problems. Of course, you're trying to explore what the problem is before you can work out the solution. So that, I think, gave me a good grounding in, you know, always trying to come up with a problem no matter what it is. First port call is absolutely understand what the problem is before you rush to the solution. And that sounds probably quite easy and straightforward, but you'd be surprised how many people are either trying to find a solution so they can find a home, what problem is it we're trying to resolve, but after we define the solution, or not fully understanding what we're trying to achieve. And what I mean by what we're trying to achieve, it could be what problem is it we're fixing, what product are we building, what direction do we want to take the company in. You know, right. It starts that building blocks of that conversation. I guess it's a so what? What is it we're trying to do here?
Yeah.
You know, you always have to ask yourself the first question, certainly in business, is, well, what happens if we don't do it? If we understand the issue, what happens if we don't do it? And that then sort of develops a conversation in trying to hone down actually, well, this is what we're trying to resolve, and this is why it's important. So therefore, let's go and explore what we think the right solution is.
Right. Now, you've already said that problem solving started back in the day when you were a bedroom computer programmer with your Amstrad and your Acorns and whatever. So I understand you joined MHR straight after school on what we used to know as a YTS, a youth training scheme.
£27 a week.
Is that right? As much as that? But I don't want to age you, but although I think you've already done that yourself, that was more than a quarter of a century ago. And you know, what do you know now that you really wish you'd known then?
Well, I left school and I got a YTS placement in it was called Derby iTech Information Technology College. And the idea was you took a 2-year training scheme and they would try to get me placed for work. So I got a placement just towards the end of the first year then at Midland Software, or as it was known back then, and then got taken on about 3 to 4 months after. And I always had a vision coming out of school that I wanted to be a coder. I wanted to work. And at the time, it was COBOL. Very quickly, having got exposed to real COBOL, not college-based COBOL, decided, yes, not for me. And I think... what I, if I go look at and talk to my younger self, would be to don't necessarily lock yourself in on a particular trajectory, is learn as much as you can, and take every opportunity that you can. Because I remember when I got the opportunity to move from working in IT, which I absolutely loved, to being a coder, I wasn't sure. And I thought, actually, I'm quite comfortable doing what I'm doing. Now, eventually, my manager at the time talked me into it. And then after I took that opportunity, whenever an opportunity presented itself, I grabbed it. Because actually, what I quickly realized is, if I want to keep not just actually progressing into management, that wasn't a thing, but if I wanted to keep progressing, learning new skills and actually have some value to the business, I needed to sort of push myself into areas that maybe I wasn't necessarily comfortable with, but also not afraid to accept that the skills I had maybe were quickly getting out of date and I needed to keep my skills moving forward. So when the opportunity to become, I applied for the role as director, you know, so it is a vacancy that opened up. So I was about 28 at the time. And again, I took a moment thinking, well, I'm quite happy being a software architect at the time. I'm quite happy doing this. I've got influence over the design of the product. I'm working with a team of engineers. Do I really want to take on this extra work? And then straight away I went to the mode, well, I'm better than the last guy that I do though. And if I don't do it and they hire somebody who I'm better than, who I think I'm better than, I've got nobody else to blame other than myself. So in the end, I went for it and I got it. And it was probably the best decision at that time that I made, because all of a sudden I was able to then sort of move my skills away from just not necessarily about technology, but actually start thinking about the business impact of what we were doing. And what I mean by the business impact is the business impact of the software decisions we were taking in terms of what we designed, how it's built, who we targeted it as, the importance of calling out problems, and if software wasn't fit, don't be afraid to have the difficult conversations. All of those things suddenly coalesced into be helping me, I think, get into that role quite quickly. Because throughout my career, you've had to do bits of that, but when I got to this leadership role, it all came together.
Okay, you said in there that you'd moved on from the technology. It wasn't necessarily the technology, but you clearly have always loved the technology. You always really, you know, thrived within it. Is it important to have something that you love at the base of what you do, whether you have this great trajectory through the business or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I still love the technology. Don't ask me to write any code. I can write some pretty good C code. I might even still know a bit of Pascal still, but. So I'm not concerned myself with learning Python or any of the new languages, but I concern myself with what the potential of the technology is. And that's the exciting bit. I've got people now who can do the coding, but I get excited by what the opportunity. So we take, for example, AI. AI is going to present so many opportunities for people to do things differently. And it's going to provide so many opportunities to help businesses become more efficient, help people to become better at what they do. That's a bit now I find exciting. So the technology excites me, but I don't need to know how to build it. Just need to know what the potential of it is.
Okay.
That's where the conversations now go.
Right. And that feeds into something else. I mean, I read a letter you wrote to the Financial Times recently in which you said, nurturing high performance from your workforce depends on who you choose to surround yourself with. And so you just say there, you've got a lot of high quality people who do a lot of things that you couldn't even dream of doing, but you're excited by it.
Absolutely. And I think all good business leaders should surround themselves by people who've got skills that you don't have, because no person's an island. You can't know it all, and you shouldn't feel threatened by that. So you know you want great people, and you want great people in your organization who can build the best software. But you also want people around you who are going to challenge you and keep you on your toes, and maybe push you to thinking in different directions. Because as I say, you never stop learning. You know, you need to surround yourself with good people. And I do firmly believe part of the reason that, you know, MHRs continue to grow is that we've never been afraid to do that. We've never been afraid to identify those good people, push them, promote them. You know, if I look at myself, that's fine. But, you know, a number of the chief officers and a number of the directors in MHR are all homegrown. They've all come through the business, you know, a similar but different journey to me in terms of their background. But they are in senior positions now, having a big influence on the way the company goes.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. So, but MHR is first and foremost a family firm. You know, I remember years ago seeing John Mills out there, a very successful, high-profile business leader, and his daughter is now the chairman of the board. How does a CEO who's not a family member, albeit you've risen through the ranks, manage that kind of leadership dynamic?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, John and Jessica are incredibly supportive, and I think because they're always investing for the long term, it makes the conversations about where we want to take the business a lot easier, because you're not having to worry about budgets and making business cases. That we're all aligned on the fact that we want MHR to be here for the next 40 years as well, and we reinvest a lot of our money, so that removes a degree of friction from the conversations. But ultimately, we've got a relationship where, you know, the John just said, look, actually, we think we want to go this direction, and I can have a view on that. But coming out of that discussion, there's an accord. Now, sometimes the discussion may be, look, well, this is what we want. I'll go and execute against that. Sometimes the conversation is, look, what do you think about this? We're thinking of this. What do you think? And again, there's a free and open conversation about that. I think ultimately, it's about understanding. It's about the balance of understanding what they want and what they want for the business, being able to execute on that, but also have a say and a contributor to that. But fundamentally, it's about that relationship of taking what they say, understanding it, and saying, well, this is how we're going to meet on it. But it is, as I said at the start of this section, it's made all the easier that we've got the family who are committed to reinvesting in the business. Now, we reinvest 20% of our turnover back into the business, which is, you know,
it's a big amount of money.
Yeah. So, you know, my job is to make sure that we spend that money effectively, of course, but we're constantly moving the company forward for the future.
Got you. You know, you've been there for 30 odd years, you know, man and boy, as it were. Could an apprentice or a trainee joining a firm today have a similar one company career success, do you think?
I absolutely do, and no, we've got over 200 people in our company who've been here more than 10 years. You know, we've got a guy who's been here longer than I have. You know, so I think, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's about finding the right company, of course. But I think, you know, if you want to be able to sort of stay and establish yourself in one company, it comes back to what I said at the start. You've got to be prepared to sort of push yourself. Even I've got software engineers who've been working in our company for 30 years, but they've moved through different technologies. They've had to reskill and relearn. So that's their way of pushing themselves. You know, so if you're prepared to do that, you're prepared to move with the times, take on board new ideas, not be afraid of change, and you're in an organization that promotes that and invests in the long term, absolutely you can, without question. And you can also move across the organization, or you can move up the organization.
So everybody doesn't have to have a portfolio career?
I don't think so. And I think if you look at some of the big companies, you know, like the Apples of the world and Microsoft, a lot of their leaders are people who've grown through the business. They've come through the ranks. Very rarely, I suspect the next CEO of Apple won't be somebody they've just brought in from the outside. It will be somebody who's worked their way through other management and leadership positions within that organization. Same with Microsoft. Same has happened with Google. You know, and I think it's, so for us, it's about developing that talent further down the ranks. So we not only have we got the best technical people, but actually we are developing the next set of leaders. And that's really important. Yeah, but we people who've been through the business, who've worked in different parts of the business, end up being better rounded people to take on those leadership positions, if that makes sense.
Okay. Okay. So looking back on your own leadership so far, is there an incident, event that makes you think, oh, Lord, I really could have done a bit better there?
Yeah, I think in my early days, I think certainly with director, you can get a little locked onto delivering to timescales. And I think there's certainly one occasion where I look back on my younger self thinking, actually, I should have had the grown-up conversation about a software project not being ready to be released to customers rather than worrying about hitting a date. And I think that I got stung by that in terms of, you know, you having to sort of deal with unhappy customers. And I sort of promised myself, well, what's harder, dealing with unhappy customers or going in and having a difficult conversation, which if you have early enough, actually really isn't that difficult, you know? So I think, you know, having gone through that, and I thought, look back in hindsight, I think actually probably was a useful thing to go through, but at the time I didn't think that. I think that sort of, actually, that's not happening again, and actually customers down again, we'll have the conversation about holding things back or calling out things not being ready. We'll deal with that way.
I guess that's something that comes with time and experience.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. In the race to prove yourself, sometimes you can rush to a decision. Power of time and hindsight, you're much better making the right decision rather than just making a decision that puts you in the best line. Difference of telling people what they want to hear versus what they need to hear, I guess.
Good stuff. Right. So, and on the other side of the coin, what do you reckon has been perhaps one of your greatest single leadership successes, maybe?
Well, I'm going to be very proud of where the company's come since I've got into this particular position. Equally, when I was CTO, the project and came up with the idea of the project of being one of the first fully web-enabled HR and payroll platforms on the market, which is in sort of 2003. So I look at that and I'm very proud of that. And that's what I trend, and that's still a, you know, a popular, successful product today. But there's no doubt, I think, seeing the company grow, seeing people's careers develop, seeing new people coming into the business, some of those straight out of school like myself, it's a proud moment. And we take the job seriously. Everybody that we employ, they're part of the MHR family, and we value everybody's job. And we also take the responsibility of 900 mortgages, 900 families extremely seriously. So I'm very proud of that.
Good stuff. Right. And finally, as you know, this is a pod for the Nottingham Business School. So if I was to ask you to offer everyone here, that's colleagues, partners, students, academics, one piece of leadership advice from your career so far.
It's a hard question. Yeah, I think the importance of having good people around you can't be understood. If I look back on all of my, even from my very early management positions to director, CTO, CEO, it's always been made easy when you've got good people around you who you can rely on to help you get through things, and you can trust to do some of the, what I call maybe the ugly work. So if I think about my time as CTO, I had a great team of managers. No matter what the problem is, we get together and say, guys, I need you to fix this. They go away and get me a resolution to it. So I think the importance of surrounding yourself with good people and people you can trust cannot be understated.
So it's everyone else, not yourself, is it not?
Well, I think ultimately, you know, I think when I was, you know, everybody knows that I'm more, I will stand in front of them and be the shield. My job is to make sure that people can get their jobs done. And no matter, even to my very first management role where I had a team of three people, my job was to make sure that they got what they need. And the stuff that was important, we dealt with. The stuff that didn't need to be dealt with, I saved them from that distraction. And that's really no different today. You know, my day-to-day, there's so much incoming. All of it's important, but there's different degrees of importance. So I need to be able to, if I look at my role now, I've got a great team of chief officers around me who can get stuff done. But equally, they need me to sort of help them. So it's a sounds trite. It's a two-way street. No manager, no matter how capable they are, can survive if they haven't built a good team of people around.
Sound leadership advice. So Anton Rowe, Chief Exec of MHR International, it's been a great pleasure to welcome you to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Great talking.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with the Chief Executive of MHR International, Anton Rowe, why not listen to previous episodes with the former Vice President of Toyota Europe, Marvin Cook OBE, the CEO of transport tech company Microlise, Nadeem Raza, or the Director of Global Technology Strategy at IHG Hotels and Resorts, Bal Bansal. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.